Have you filled out your NCAA tournament brackets? Do you have a March Madness office pool in the works? Financial planner Kevin McKinley has some words to the wise on whether this is a good idea during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, information on how cable TV changes that are coming up may change how much you pay and what you watch. Also, answers to questions about Bitcoin and advice for you if you have a personal finance question. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Well, we are in the middle of March Madness, and even if you're not a basketball fan, you may want to pay attention. I am not a huge basketball fan, Kevin, so what is this March Madness you speak of?
Well, March, I prefer the term March Madness instead of March Mental Illness.
Yeah, but, that's true.
Right. It's a field was announced Sunday, 68 teams. The first game is Tuesday and today, and there's a play-in for real four teams.
So I'm sorry. So we're going to have four teams. I lost that.
Yeah, there's the four games of play-in teams, and 50 million workers, according to Microsoft, are going to be participating, and Challenger and Gray estimates that there's going to be a cost to lost productivity of $1.2 billion, and there is a way that you can make big money off of the particular tournament.
Well, we have a listener on Facebook who wants to know, are these even legal? Are these office pools legal to sponsor or to play in?
It depends. Several things. One of if you cross state lines or if you use an online network. According to state statute, though, in Wisconsin, to participate in one of these or sponsor it is a Class B misdemeanor, and that's according to LegalZoom. If you're not paying to get into the tournament, no problem. But if you are paying a fee, according to the definition of the law, this is a game of chance, not a game of skill. And so because a private game of chance tends to be illegal, this is not legal. However, the likelihood of arrest, especially with the 50 million people playing, is very small. Where you're probably more likely to get into trouble is using your work computer to participate in the tournament, trade profanity-laced emails back and forth, or watch the games online.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. But let's say you're not playing for money. Any tips for winning?
Sure. Skip the favorites, according to history. Only since the seeds have come through in 1979. In 3 years, there have been no number one seeds, only in 1 year when all number ones have made it. And this year is probably going to be more so that the number ones are likely to get bounced out because there aren't any real clear favorites at the top. You also want to check rankings, independent rankings, not the seeds. Use a site like KenPom.com, USA Today's rankings, ESPN, Nate Silver, the prognosticator who correctly predicted the presidential election. And then, of course, go to the final arbiter of what is likely to happen, Vegas, and see what the odds are there. You probably want to pick an upset in at least one bracket. If you're right, everybody will remember it. But when you're wrong, which you inevitably will be, nobody will remember that.
So is there really a way that we can make money off of March Madness?
Yes, very easily. Just get all the games right by entering a pool sponsored by Warren Buffett and Quicken Loans. The prize is $1 billion with a B dollars. The odds are only 1 in 9.2 quintillion. Now, that's, of course, taking the fact that all tournament entrants have an equal chance of winning. And that, of course, is not true because it's very unlikely to say that the 16 seed will beat a 1 seed. So you can narrow that down to 1 in 5 quintillion pretty easily. You have to go to quickenloansbracket.com for other rules and prizes. You do have to sign up for it with your email address. You do have to have a Yahoo account, etc. And you may get bombarded with some advertising information. But, hey, it could be worth $1 billion.
$1 billion. Well, Thanks a billion, Kevin, and my apologies for a little bit of a technical difficulty that made Kevin sound a little echoey, and I think Kevin was hearing a little bit of an echo, too, but all is okay now. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. Keith says, my brother swears by your show on Wisconsin Public Radio and suggested I try my question. He goes on to say, I have two 401ks from previous employers. And what he wants to know, Kevin, is he is 57, but due to a disability, he'll have to make an early withdrawal for living expenses soon. Should I do a rollover IRA? If so, which 401k or both? Is there an advantage to leaving them as 401ks? He also mentions that he's applying for Social Security disability benefits and signs off by saying that he is a new On Your Money fan. So some good, genuine praise there.
We better get to this question quickly because that ardor and love goes away very quickly. So I wanted to grab this right away. We have some good news for Keith's unfortunate situation. Usually under 59 and a half, people who are under that age who try to pull money out of an IRA or a 401k pay not only taxes on the withdrawal, but also a penalty. But if he leaves it with a 401k at the company, he will still pay taxes, but no 10% penalty on the withdrawal as long as he's over 55. And that's whether or not he has a disability. That's true for all people. So if you are separating from employment, you do have a 401k and you're over 55, most people can pull the money out of that account without paying a penalty on it. And if he only takes what he needs out of it, that will keep his income very low. And by definition, he should probably pay little or nothing in taxes on that as well.
Okay, then should he leave all of his money in the 401ks or not?
He may be able to, but not necessarily. He should at least try to plan out getting him to 59 and a half. And for instance, if he has $100,000 in there and he figures out that he's going to need $2,000 a month for the next 50 months, he should leave that amount at least enough in there so that he can pull it from the 401k without paying the penalty. But other people will choose to take it out of their safety. Investment choices aren't the best. He might want more control over the investments, more knowledge, less expensive funds, or even more safety. Usually can't get investments like treasury bills or CDs, et cetera, in a 401k. And many employers do eventually force separated employees out, meaning they say, hey, you don't work for us anymore. We don't want to be responsible for this account. So let us know where to send the money to another IRA, or we're just going to send you a check with the taxes and penalties withheld.
So does his disability application have any effect at all on his situation?
There's some good news and bad news there. The good news is that if he does have a permanent and total disability, the IRS lets him pull money out of the retirement account at any time, at any age, with taxes, but with no penalty. However, the assets can affect the amount of disability that he can qualify for. So he might want to get some help from a lawyer, especially one who is trained in Social Security disability applications. We'll put a link up to the specific language at the Social Security website. Up at our website, onyourmoney.com. And Keith may also want to go to lawyers.com again to find an attorney who specializes in this particular situation.
Thanks again, Keith, for the praise and for listening to On Your Money. Hope that helps. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones. We have Dave in Superior with us. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. last week you mentioned to a caller that they could open a Roth IRA and roll a certain amount from traditional into Roth at their current tax rate, if it's, say, 15%, up to where it converts to 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And that struck a bell, and I was wondering if that can still be done in this year's tax season for 2013.
That's a great question, and the answer is no. The contribution to a Roth IRA, or IRA for that matter, can definitely be done still in 2014 for the 2013 tax year. However, the conversion, the idea of moving an IRA into a Roth IRA and having it come on as technically taxable income, means that you have to have that done by the end of December 31st of the actual year in question. So you can still do it right now, Dave, but the problem is that if you do it right now, it will count for the 2014 tax year, not for 2013.
Simplifies my life immensely.
All right. Good luck to you, Dave. We'll take more of your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money, you can make a splash.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up on the program, we'll talk about whether Bitcoin is a good investment and more answers to your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Aurora in Madison is with us now. Hello, Aurora.
Hi. I have to say I'm not worthy.
let us be the judge of that, Aurora. Okay.
My question is: so we took a loss on our home selling it, and so to deal with that, we cashed out like one of my first 401ks, my first job that I had totally forgot about, and to pay for that loss. And when I talk to the people, they're like, oh, you're not going to have to pay, you know, we'll take the taxes out and there shouldn't be a penalty or whatever. But when I started doing my taxes on TurboTax or whatever, it said they said I had to pay a penalty on it, basically. I think it was like 5% or 10%. And I didn't know. I was trying to read, and I found some different articles that said you could potentially use it towards a loss, but maybe to the purchase of another home, which we ended up buying another home, but I'm not sure.
No, you can't use the loss as a deduction. It's only if it's a property, if you use it like as a commercial property or rental real estate or something like that, that you cannot take a loss on that. So that's the bad news for you. The good news is if you make a gain on your next house, it's unlikely that you'll pay taxes on that as well, because you can roll the gains over into a new purchase, or you can exclude up to $500,000 of a gain for a married couple filing jointly. So sorry, Aurora, the loss is there, and there's not much you can do about it.
But that was a worthy question, Kevin.
Yes, it was a very worthy question.
But I was curious about the penalty part of it, whether or not I know I couldn't take the taxes out, I know I couldn't take a loss out on it, but the penalty I have to pay on cashing out my 401k, I thought could be waived because it was used towards a loss or the purchase of a new home.
Yes, but it has to be your first-time home, and usually the IRS defines that as if you can't have made a purchase, owned the home within 2 years of making the purchase of the new home. You can give it a shot and see what they say. Don't quote me as giving you the advice for it, but and print out those articles and bring them in hand to the eventual audit. But no, it's usually only if it actually is a first-time home that you can use a distribution from it, and even then, I think it's limited to $10,000 for the down payment of the first time purchase of the home.
Good luck, Aurora. Thank you for the call. Next, we go to Hallie in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question regarding EE bonds. before deferred income, I was purchasing EE bonds, and I understand that they stop paying interest after 20 years. Now, I have bonds that will be need to be cashed or to, don't not need to be cashed, whatever, and I'm finding that that'll raise my income considerably, and I'd have to pay taxes, and I don't know what to do with the money because I'm over 80 years old and conservative, of course, and I don't know what to do with the money because it's not going to earn any appreciable amount of interest. Do you have any suggestions or ideas?
It's difficult. Yeah, sure. It's difficult to avoid the taxes on that because you've deferred the taxes on it. And actually, I believe with the Series EE savings bonds, it's actually 30 years on bonds that were purchased from 97 through, I think, 2005. So it's 30 years that they accumulate interest for it. But and under the letter of the law, technically, you're supposed to, once they mature, if you will, and stop paying interest, you're supposed to declare the interest at that time and take them out. One thing I would do, though, is maybe pull out. I've seen several sources that I believe to be trustworthy say, no, you just, you declare the actual interest accrued once you cash the bonds in. And if that's indeed the case, then you can pull out certain bonds sequentially over years so that you might, let's say you had $5,000 in gains in 10 different bonds, so a total of $50,000 of gains, maybe pull two bonds out a year for 5 years, so you'd only have $10,000 of earned income up to it. But no, other than making other kinds of like a charitable contribution or people who have earned income on which to base an IRA contribution, there's really no way to avoid that. The good news is that you know, at least the interest did accumulate over those years, and you're probably going to be in a lower tax bracket now than in many of those years in which you would have had to otherwise pay taxes on the accumulating interest.
Thanks very much, Hallie, for the call, and good luck to you. Connie in Appleton is with us now. Hello, Connie.
Hi. I am 70 and a half this year and have to do the minimum distribution for my IRA, and I was wondering if there's any particular best time of the year to do that, earlier in the year or later or what?
It depends on your discipline, Connie. You have to do it by the end of the year, and so sooner is usually better.
Yeah.
Because then you make sure that it's done, and it's very good that you're on top of this because for people who are required to take required minimum distributions from their IRA due to their age or to an IRA that they inherited, if you don't take those out, you not only have to still take it out and pay taxes on it, but the amount you were supposed to take out can be hit with a 50% excise tax. So if you were supposed to take $10,000 out and you didn't, you can get hit with another $5,000 penalty.
Yes, I was reading that. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Karen in Milwaukee. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Kevin, I have a question about consolidating my son's college loans. He currently has $27,000 in loans, and that's over seven loans, and the average on those loans is 6%. I know you advise consolidating loans, or I think I'm right about that. And when we were working on it yesterday, and we did all the stuff online, what it came down to is he could consolidate them, but then the rate would be 6.3%, and the payments would go from $400 a month to $195 a month, which would be good for him because right now he's just working part-time and he was hoping to travel a little bit. And so, you know, $400 a month paying that is really hard for him. So, but then he looked at the fact that, okay, if he took, you know, the 20 years or whatever to pay this off, he'd end up paying $40,000. So I said, well, you know, you could pay as much as you can pay every month. I mean, if you can pay $400 or more, you know, you can do that. But then he was looking at something that said, you know, that There was penalties for prepayment, mm-hmm. but is that true on federal loans, and what would you suggest?
Well, are the loans being consolidated with a private lender?
Well, we went on a website you suggested on. I don't know which website he was going on. I think it was a federal thing that he was putting all this information into.
Sure, let me just list the websites we've listed over the last 400 or so episodes of On Your Money, and you tell me. No, it was probably ibrinfo.org.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were there, because that's where people with federal loans should go, because ibrinfo.org is a very legitimate site that tells people who have student loans out, federal student loans, what they can do to reduce their payment. And it's based on income, hence the IBR, income-based repayment info.org. And what it can allow you to do is drop the minimum payment down to stay current on the loans if your income is low enough. And under the theory of the plan anyway, is that as long as you stay current on it, after some period, like 25 years, whatever's remaining at that time is forgiven. Now, 25 years probably sounds like forever to your son. You and I both know how quickly that time will pass. So I would definitely, if you are going to consolidate it, do it through the ibrinfo.org place. You lose a lot of benefits if you do move that over to a private lender. I'm not concerned about the slightly higher interest rate, moving from 6 to 6.25, whatever is, that's not going to be his biggest issue going forward. I do like the idea of him being able to mitigate somewhat his payment so that he has more cash flow to do whatever else he needs to do with it. But keep in mind, even under that plan, the interest will accumulate, and under most conditions, and therefore he's going to have to make, he can enjoy his life now, but he's going to pay for it down the road.
Thank you very much, Karen. Good luck to you and your son. Pat in Port Washington is with us now. Hello, Pat. What's your question for Kevin?
Hello, Kevin and Joy. I have a question regarding college expenses and the 529 plan. Last year, we lost my mother and my wife's mother and inherited some money from their estates. And I think I may have made a mistake by, but the good thing is that they were both real advocates of higher education, and I have twin daughters who are seniors in high school, so they'll be in college next year. So we're using that money towards their education, and I put a large chunk of it into their 529 accounts at the end of last year because I didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I saved another big chunk and put it into those 529s after the first of this year. And then I was told by my tax person that that might not have been the best way to do it because there's some tax advantage. I was told that there's some tax advantages to paying tuition out of pocket in the form of a federal tax credit. I'm wondering if I can pull that out of the 529 prior to them going to college.
Absolutely. You can pull it out, and you will pay taxes and penalties, but just on the earnings portion. So let's say you put $10,000 in it. Let's say you're really fortunate, and in a short period of time, it grew to $11,000. And so you made $1,000 on that. And now you pull it out. And you have a choice. You can use that distribution tax-free to offset qualified higher education expenses and just about anything a kid or an adult would incur going to a higher education institution does qualify as a qualified higher education expense. So you can do that if you want. But if there aren't much in the way of earnings or profits on the account, what I would do in this case is pull the money back out. You will pay taxes and a penalty on the earnings portion of it. But then if you want, you can use the money to pay for the qualified expenses. And if you're in a higher tax bracket and there aren't much earnings, yes, the tax advisor is correct. You probably will be better off using the money and obtaining the tax credit for the payment.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. And good luck to you and your daughters. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money, talking as we do every week at this time with financial planner Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Coming up, smart assets, and we'll shop around for some good cable deals. That's coming up on Your Money here on the Ideas Network. And it is time now for the smart assets segment of the show. And we are hearing a lot about Bitcoin in the news lately. And some listeners are curious as to whether they should check out this new form of currency. Tell us about Bitcoin, Kevin.
It's called a cryptocurrency. It's a digital means of exchange of value. And it depends on if people should look into this, how they're going to use it. In my opinion, it was basically created about 5 years ago with an idea and a paper written by a shadowy figure who people think they may or may not know who this person is. Proponents like it for some reasons, including it's an easy way to transfer funds electronically from one user to another. There are no fees to it. It's anonymous. There's a limited supply. So they say that unlike, you know, fiat money like the dollar, they know how much value Bitcoin is going to have, or at least the number, the quantity for it. And there are, in their terms anyway, no taxes on the transaction whatsoever. The popularity of Bitcoin has spawned several hundred different alternatives for it, such as Flexcoin or Electrocoin is another one. Working on one right now for the show here. We've got several different possible ways we're going to it. We've got Kevin Joy Bucks. we have On Your Money Money. And then one that I really like is because it's natural. We're going to start producing wooden nickels.
That's watch out for those. So how come Bitcoin has been in the news so much lately?
Lots of intrigue going on around it, partially because the rise in dollars. Back in 2009 or 2010, it was worth fractions of a penny. As a matter of fact, one guy said, hey, I've got a bunch of bitcoins. I'll give 10,000 bitcoins out right now for someone who will bring me a pizza. Someone did. He transferred the bitcoins to that person. And bitcoins and dollars rose up to about $1,200 as of last Thanksgiving and are currently right around $600. So that pizza cost or earned the other person somewhere around $5 to $8 million, depending on which day you're checking it. More businesses are announcing that they're accepting bitcoins in payment. Overstock.com is one. Some car dealerships are saying it. I think they're doing this more for the publicity and trying to look, you know, cool and hip and progressive, like they know what they're doing. Newsweek had an article where they said they found the founder of Bitcoin, the gentleman in Japan. This guy denies that he is the actual founder of it or so, and there's some question in that case. But the biggest reason they hit the news was there was an exchange that was originally created to hold Magic the Gathering cards. It was called Mt. Gox. That's an acronym for Magic the Gathering, that held several hundred million dollars worth of Bitcoin. The exchange was hacked, the bitcoins were stolen, and so the people who had held their bitcoins as part of this exchange technically lost several hundred million dollars in value.
That's not good. Probably not good for the perception of this currency.
Nope. And it brought out lots of opinions and attentions on it. The regulators in New York are looking at it. The IRS is trying to figure out how to tax it and how it should be treated as part of the tax system. FINRA, the securities industry self-regulatory organization, said people should stay away from it. Warren Buffett, Goldman Sachs, Jamie Dimon from Bank of America. A lot of people said, hey, this thing is a scam. Get away from it. And of course, many proponents of Bitcoin say, yeah, that's exactly what these titans of finance would say. They feel it's a threat to their well-being, and so they don't want people to get involved in it.
So, Kevin, are you hip or not? What's your opinion on the
subject? I am the least hip person I know. I think that, you know, e-currency not only has some precedent, like with PayPal or digital payments, we're doing that all the time. Very few of us are actually moving large amounts of dollars from one place to another. It's usually debit cards, credit cards, transferring balances from a checking account, et cetera. So there's some precedent to it. And PayPal is one of those kinds of companies, and they're also trying to come up with with a token that as eBay is too, that would simulate the advantages of Bitcoin. If you're using it to buy and sell, sure, if as long as you're comfortable with that and you know how to handle it for tax issues for it. But it could become a game of musical chairs if the value of Bitcoin, like any other currency, starts to fall rapidly. A lot of people are buying into it because they've seen it rise rapidly and they say that's a good thing. I sold a product for $100 2 years ago and now that $100 is worth, say, $5,000. So they want to get their payments in Bitcoin, hoping that it will continue to go up in value. If you're doing that, you're speculating. And as with any speculative investment, any amount that of money that you put into this, you should expect it to go to zero. And then if and when it doesn't, you will be pleasantly surprised.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. He is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And we have an open line now for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Dave in Waukesha. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is about co-signing for student loans. My daughter has already graduated school. She is paying off the loan. She has a 4-year history of paying off her loans on time, but they will not release us as co-signers. And if I get our credit, how do I get out of that?
Yeah, the reason that they won't is because they don't think she's going to pay it back, that she's not in a situation yet to do it. Has she tried to apply for any kind of refinancing proposition for those loans?
I'm directly asking us to get removed.
Dave, I'm sorry. Say that again.
She's only asked the lenders to get removed. To have us removed. She hasn't attempted to refinance them.
Okay, and that's good. That's the first step. I would have her try to do it, but if she doesn't have a very positive credit history or she doesn't have any income or a great credit score, which would be obvious in the situation, it is going to be very difficult to get you off of the loan by the private lender for it. It's only her credit history that they'll go for. So unless, that was part of the condition of you getting the loan in the first place, was that they knew, hey, a lot of 18 or 20 or 22-year-olds or 52-year-olds, for that matter, may not be able to pay these loans off right away or ever, therefore we need someone with better credit before we're going to give you the money. That's why you're on there, and that's also the reason that it's still difficult for you to get off. Once she gets a job, has a positive credit history, has income that they feel that they can pay it off, then it will be possible for her to go on and refinance the loans, and then and only then will you be able to get off of it.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Richard in Madison uses Bitcoin. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Joy. How are you today?
I'm good. Tell us about your experience with Bitcoin.
Sure. Well, I started using them in about 2011. I read Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper, and I thought it was a pretty visionary idea, so I bought a few just really to kind of experiment with. And since then, I guess you could say I've been won over to them. I use them pretty much exclusively for shopping on the Internet. I don't use my credit card anymore. I've switched to using that. And I wanted to say, too, that I think Kevin has kind of missed some of the really important things, at least in terms of persuading me, were that this is an open-source project, that nobody has any control over the supply of Bitcoin. That's almost unique outside of maybe gold or something like that.
Yeah, what about that, Kevin?
Well, I actually agree with Richard, mm-hmm. but the difference is that where a lot of people see that as a feature, I see it as a bug. And the fact that people I don't mind if someone came to me in his case and said, here's what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to experiment with it and see what it works. I would be all for that. Again, as long as you are comfortable using an amount of money to start with, or if you're trading a service or a good or whatever for it, that if you said, hey, if this doesn't work out or I don't like it, yeah, it might be too bad, but it won't be the kind of thing that will ruin me financially for it, because it's still in a very nascent stage. And even someone like Richard, who sounds like an educated proponent of Bitcoin, will acknowledge that even if it continues to exist in its form in some way, the value can swing wildly, as we've mentioned. Now, that's been good generally for people who have Bitcoins. But if you would have accepted payment, say, in $1,000 in a Bitcoin back in, let's say, 3 or 4 months ago, it's probably worth what right now, Richard? Maybe $600 per unit?
Maybe 640 this morning. Something.
Okay, so that's fine. And if someone got into it at a lower conversion value, but like any currency, whether it's the euro or pesos, whatever, you have a very a wide range in the fluctuation. So unless you're comfortable with that, or unless you could say I'm comfortable with the wide range of fluctuation because I want it to fluctuate wildly upward and I think it's going to, then I'm okay with that. But that's where people who maybe aren't comfortable with that should be careful.
Thanks very much, Richard, for the call. We need to move on. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up, information on how cable TV changes may change how much you pay and what you watch. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around.
This is the Shop Around segment of this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, by the way, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And there are potential changes to the cable landscape that could affect what you watch and how much you pay, Kevin.
Yes, let's start first with a review of the On Your Money method for cutting your monthly expenses that go towards cable, thousands of dollars per year. The average cable bill right now for the television broadcast portion is about $90 per month. That's only gone up and probably only will go up. If you're willing to cut the cord and cancel or reduce your cable service, just keep the internet above and beyond, and then subscribe to a service like Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu Plus, and then get your broadcast channels on over-the-air TV. And by the way, there's a great website, antennaweb.org, that will tell you not only what broadcast stations are available in your area, but also what the best kind of antenna is to get to reach each one of those stations. And you might end up spending $10 to $30 per month, depending on the type of services you choose to purchase. And I can guarantee few things in life other than that whichever service you provide, it will be provide more programming that you will be able to watch in one lifetime.
Yeah, I got to consider that because I know that my bill is more than $90 a month, and I really don't watch that much cable TV with my hours. So what are the changes that are coming down the road that might affect this way of watching TV?
According to the Global Internet Phenomenon Report, and they should know, right now Netflix takes up about a third of all downstream traffic, and then YouTube constitutes enough so that between those two sites alone, that takes up about half of the internet traffic right now that's downstream of that's going from the provider to the end user consumer. And the cable companies, of course, see this, and if they're watching either Netflix or YouTube, they're not watching cable television, and they're not needing cable television. And many of the cable companies actually provide the internet pipes, if you will, so that those transmissions can go through. So they want to, some people have accused some cable companies of actually limiting or metering the amount of streaming so that Netflix has a more unfortunate experience for the end user. I sure wouldn't blame them if they did that. I'm not sure they should be doing that. I don't think that's correct. But Netflix actually went to one of the cable providers and said, hey, we want to get access to be in your boxes so people can go directly through their Comcast box rather than, an enabled DVD player or a Roku or whatever. And we want to be able to get on your box and we'll pay you for that, right? And then we want to make sure that our users get the highest quality stream so that they can enjoy the Netflix service. And because Comcast and Time Warner are merging, that has been put on hold for the time being. And then also, there's the idea of net neutrality. If right now we have a net neutrality arrangement where there is no favorite content, but if Netflix is on Comcast's box and Comcast has an agreement with them, people are worried that Netflix will get a better path than other broadcast sources such as Amazon Prime or Hulu Plus.
Yeah, so what steps do you recommend in light of the developments?
I would talk to your current provider and say, I'm thinking about quitting. And I'd like to know if there are any less expensive ways I can get what I want, what I need from you and remain a customer. And even if you do quit and try it for a couple months or whatever, if you change your mind, they will be more than happy to bring you back. They will not reject you. They're not like a spurned lover. sometimes the relationship does feel a little bit like that. But you might want to look at combining your phone and your internet and your cable TV if you haven't done so already. Look at Dish, what it provides and versus the cost, especially in your area. If you are going to go to an internet-only broadcast entertainment system, you definitely want to get the highest speed you possibly can because that will make it more likely that you'll enjoy it and get the best modem that you can as well. This is a case, too, Joy, where I would think a lot of people might want to go back to DVDs if they are having problems getting in, you know, if they getting the broadcast speed. DVDs are extremely cheap. As part of Netflix, you can actually get them, and you can buy them and rent them for just a few bucks. Every time I go through Shopko, they're sitting, you know, fairly recent ones are sitting there for $4 or $5. And, of course, you can go to the public library, too, and borrow DVDs as well. So that's virtually little or nothing. Just make sure you also get a very good DVD player. The best ones right now cost about $80.
Yeah, I got one of those. Here's another change, Kevin, that I just was notified of this month from my cable television company. They're going 100% digital, and it means that I'll have to buy one of those boxes for every TV.
Oh, that's really weird. So, in other words, they're making a big switch that's for the user, but actually is going to increase the revenue that they're bringing in?
That's what's going to happen.
It's very strange. I don't know if they understood the ramifications of this decision, but it is what it is.
Yeah, so, well, I guess I'll just have to consider my options here. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. 1-800-642-1234 is our number. If you have a question for Kevin, you can also email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mike in La Crosse is with us. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Say, Kevin, I have a traditional 401k with my employer, and they just recently started offering a Roth 401k, and I'm wondering if I think I should switch to that or what the ramifications are.
Are you talking about converting to the Roth, like, or moving it, or contributing, or both?
Yeah, probably not converting, but just starting to contribute to the Roth portion instead of the traditional.
Okay, yeah, we're going to cover this in a few weeks, but if only you, Mike, promise to listen, everybody else turns the radio off for the next 30 seconds or so. I think it's a good idea, but only do it in a year in which you are in a extremely low tax bracket. And by that I mean you're laid off, you have a lot of business losses or capital losses or something like that that drives your income down. The advantage of the Roth 401k is that when you pull the money out in retirement, you pay no taxes on it. But if you put money into a Roth 401k right now, you don't get the benefit of the tax break that you do by making contributions to the original 401k. So the only time to do it is when you're in a lower tax bracket in the year in question than you think you will be in retirement. And because most people live on less in retirement, some by design, some by necessity. Other people, according to the progressive tax bracket, pay very little in taxes, even though they're taking all the money that they need out of it. Most people are, probably half the people who are working right now are likely to be in a lower overall income tax bracket when they retire, and therefore it's probably not a good idea to use the Roth 401k. What I could recommend is use the traditional 401k for as much as you can contribute to and stand to set aside. And then if you still want that tax deferral, open up a Roth IRA, because the Roth IRA, you can pull the contributions out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties, but then you'll still get the tax deferral while you're waiting to retire, and then it will be tax-free when you do retire.
All right, Mike, tune in a few weeks for more details, and everybody else can turn their radios up. Charles in Greenfield is with us. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Joan. Jane, rather.
Joan or Jane? No, it's Joy. It's okay, Charles.
Sorry about that. A little nervous here. I'd like to know if I can contribute $6,500 to a Roth IRA for 2013. My wife and I had a joint income, total income of $148,000. Most of that was pension, dividends, and interest. But my wife had a salary of $8,100. My wife died in 2013, and I'm wanting to know if I can contribute this to a spousal IRA, which I already have from previous years.
Oh, Charles, and I'm so sorry for your loss, and it's okay. People call me all sorts of names. So
yeah, and I'm still nervous. too. So I understand completely. Charles, I'm sorry for your loss too. Have you checked with that? Do you do your own taxes, Charles, or do you have a CPA?
Yes, I do my own taxes.
Okay. This might be a good year where it not only because of the passing of your wife, but also because of this question for it. My understanding is this, there is no ruling on this because I don't know the legal definition of this, and I don't think the IRS has ruled on this specifically. My instinct is that you cannot do this, in part because the person making the contribution at this point is not alive. And if it had been made, let's say she were alive in January 2013 and you made the contribution at that time, I think you could do that. I don't think that the tax benefits of making the contribution are going to be worth the hassle of not only checking with a CPA on this, but also running afoul of the IRS if they look at it and determine that it was not appropriate. And the reason being is that, yes, you'll defer some taxes on the contribution now, but then, of course, you'll just have to start taking it out according to the required minimum distribution and pay taxes at that time. And if you already have pension income and Social Security, et cetera, there's a good chance, and if you're filing as a single filer, there's a good chance that you'll pay just as much in taxes on it when you pull it out as you were able to defer by doing it right now. So you can try it if you want. My suggestion is that you don't.
Okay. This is a Roth IRA, but that doesn't make any difference.
Even more so then, because you won't get any tax benefit from doing it. You'll only get a deferral on the Roth IRA. And the nice thing about it is you don't have an RMD for it. So then the savings are only going to be on whatever earnings the Roth IRA produced at some point. And if you're investing appropriately, you should probably be fairly conservative right about now. So you probably won't make very much on that as well over your the time you're in the Roth IRA.
Thanks for the call, Charles. Our best to you. Sam emails, I have an ongoing argument with my husband about buying or leasing cars. He insists that leasing is the way to go, but I don't get it. I don't drive much, probably 10,000 miles a year. Could you end this debate once and for all?
Absolutely. The on your money rule of thumb for settling debates, especially between two people in a relationship, is that if you are the person who contacts us with the question,
you're right.
You're correct. That's right. So, Sam, leasing can be the way to go. But the problem with leasing is not the lease itself. It's the things buried within the lease that a lot of people don't get. Some people just go in and say, hey, I want to buy a car, and they end up walking out with a lease payment that they feel is very affordable, but they don't understand the interest rate on the lease. They don't understand the depreciation value of the vehicle in the meantime for it. So I actually do like leasing as a way to own a car or get the use of a car, if you will, for a relatively short period of time. I do not like it for owning a car for a long period of time. But if you don't think you're going to be driving very much, leasing can be a good way to get into a brand new car every 3 years for a relatively low cost. And the nice thing about it, you don't have to come up with a big down payment usually, and you are it's very unlikely that you will have maintenance expenses, because hopefully you are leasing a new car every single time. That's not only going to be more reliable, but also could be covered under the warranty.
You know, if you are having a debate with your spouse or anybody else, Kevin and I invite you to send us your situation via email. Maybe we'll set you up for a future segment.
Yeah, and we're going to try to stick to financial issues.
Yeah, that's right. Okay? It has to be financial issues.
Right.
And you can send that email too, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time for the website of the week, Kevin.
If you are considering cutting the cable cord and moving to other sources of broadcast entertainment, you may want to go to canistream.it. It allows you to punch in any movie or television show, and it will tell you not only if it's available from the various streaming services, but how to go about it and what the cost would be. Canistream.it, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Both Kevin and I will be off next week. John Munson will be here talking with a personal finance expert about your personal finances on the next edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.